update from the Texas Tribune. 3,311 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of September 15th, 390 less than a week ago. They occupy 6% of hospital beds. 4,816 new cases were reported on September 15th, 26,955 more than a week ago. 14,343 Texans have died as of September 15th, 132 more deaths reported than the day before, and 790 more than a week ago. And now here are some short coronavirus briefs. In the headlines, COVID-19 is killing Hispanic, Black, and American Indian children in much higher numbers than among their white peers, federal statistics show. Amid the pandemic, more than 50 American municipalities in three states have declared racism to be a public health crisis. The number of Americans with health insurance dropped last year before the pandemic struck, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. The novel coronavirus may have circulated in the U.S. as early as December, about a month earlier than believed by the CDC, according to researchers with UCLA. Big Ten Conference reverses decision to postpone season and will play football in October. Lilly's coronavirus antibody treatment shows modest signs it may treat infection. Goal is that no American will have to pay a single dime for COVID-19 vaccine, health official says. Pelosi continues to defend stimulus negotiation stance. Retail sales growth slowed down in August. Now we'll go straight into our reports. Our first is from Texas columnist Ross Ramsey. Analysis: it's hard to make good pandemic policy if the Texas data is fuzzy.
This is Ross Ramsey's Unconventional Wisdom, brought to you by Texas Association of School Business Officials. Discover the heroes behind the scenes that help make Texas schools run effectively at tasbo.org/gr.
This is Ross Ramsey from the Texas Tribune. Today's column: it's hard to make good pandemic policy if the Texas data is fuzzy. One of the end-all be-all coronavirus indicators, one that the governor of Texas has said he uses to make decisions about whether and how to respond to the pandemic, has turned out to be pretty rough around the edges. By the state's own standards, the Texas calculation of the positivity rate tests negative. More than 6 months into the coronavirus pandemic, the state is changing the way it accounts for the spread of infections. Governor Greg Abbott made a big deal of positivity rates way back at the beginning of the pandemic. It was a new and unfamiliar term at the time, a way to measure the spread of the virus by tracking how many COVID-19 tests come back positive. A positivity rate of 10% would mean 100 positive results for every 1,000 tests. It also just happens to be Abbott's original danger signal, an arbitrary number he chose as a warning that the coronavirus was spreading too quickly and that a response was needed. By the same logic, a descending positivity rate that drops below 10% might mean it's time to loosen some restrictions. That's great if the numbers are reliable and if the testing is widespread enough to be meaningful. But according to the Texas Department of State Health Services, the numbers haven't been as well-founded as they seemed. The state isn't flying blind exactly, but it's flying without true readings from its instruments. From now on, the rate will reflect the date a test was done, instead of the date the test results were reported to health authorities, a date that sometimes falls weeks or months after a test is administered. The new operation will be more accurate eventually. Daily rates will be recalculated as new results for a given date are reported. And the change amounts to an admission that the system up to now has been flawed by the vagaries of how and when results are reported to authorities. That flaw remains, but the new accounting will at least put positive test results on the right dates, no matter how slowly they're reported. And therein lies another bug in the soup. Decision makers will still have to wonder, as they look at daily trends around the coronavirus, whether their current information is accurate. They'll be able to say, as they're saying about the system that's being replaced, that they acted on the best information they had at any given time. But they won't be able to say that the information was precise at the time it was used to make decisions in response to the pandemic. The results and the changes to the calculations are not just stuff for people in lab coats to talk about. The rate produces a precise-looking number, one that is often reported out to two decimal points, that's used by elected officials who open and close businesses and schools and all the rest. Squint at the numbers, recall what was going on at the time, and you see the government's actions in miniature. The rates rise in the spring, and Abbott closes schools, bars, restaurants, and other non-essential businesses. The numbers begin to flatten a few weeks later, and the reopenings begin. They begin to rise rapidly through May and June, and new closings are imposed, along with pleas to wear masks, to stay socially distanced, and to keep scrubbing your hands. They drop again, and public schools and colleges open at varying speeds to in-person classes. Now, the state admits, Abbott and others have been relying on questionable data. Last month, Rajesh Nandi, associate professor of biostatistics and epidemiology at the University of North Texas Health Science Center at Fort Worth, said of the positivity rates from county and state health officials that, quote, they're not useless, but they are highly qualified and unreliable in terms of studying the trend, end quote. What's more, the reliability of the positivity rate depends on how many tests are being conducted. Testing in Texas hasn't been a steady statewide effort, and that produces weak spots in the data public health officials are using to track the coronavirus. The positivity rate is a big deal, but it's not the only number out there, and never was in the eyes of epidemiologists and policymakers. Hospitalization and death rates, among other things, are also closely watched and used, along with all of the other numbers, to figure out how to counter the virus when and where it flares up. That's a lot easier if the numbers accurately measure what the coronavirus is doing. This is Ross Ramsey. Thanks for listening.
Tuesday, the Texas Supreme Court once again blocked Harris County from sending mail-in ballot applications to all its 2.4 million registered voters ahead of the November election. Nevertheless, across the country in states where they do allow mail-in voting, the post office is gearing up. Here's this report.
Absentee ballots for the upcoming November election have already been mailed to voters in North Carolina, and voters in about two dozen more states can expect theirs in the coming weeks. A record number of Americans are expected to cast their ballots by mail this year due to the pandemic. NPR's Brian Naylor reports on how the Postal Service is gearing up.
Postmaster General Louis DeJoy pledged to senators last month that the agency he heads is, in his words, capable and committed to delivering the nation's election mail fully and on time. Some 37% of Americans cited in a recent survey say they plan to cast their ballots by mail this year. Amber McReynolds, who directs the National Vote at Home Institute, says that shouldn't stretch the capacity of the Postal Service.
They process over 400 million pieces of mail a day. There's not even half of that many voters in the country. So even if every single voter requested a mail ballot, that would essentially add a little bit of capacity, and that would all mean that would have to be returned on one day, which we also know doesn't happen.
The Postal Service has begun preparing for the election mail influx. Ron Stroman, the former number two at the agency, says much of that preparation involves training postal workers.
It's a very intense training regimen to make sure that the employees who are going to handle election mail understand all of the processes that are required and all of the practices that have been put into place so that they can efficiently move and process election mail.
Practices such as making sure all ballots receive a postmark and are tagged to make sure they receive special attention. Upon becoming Postmaster General, DeJoy instituted cost-cutting changes at the agency, decreeing that late-arriving mail be left behind rather than using additional trucks. In addition, some mail sorting equipment deemed surplus was removed from service. Stroman, who stepped down from the Postal Service after DeJoy took over, says while there is enough capacity at most postal facilities to handle more mail, there could be some problems at specific locations where, for example, only a single sorting machine remains in place.
You have no backup, and it may take hours, it could take days to fix that. And if that happens in the middle of an election, what is the impact on the election?
DeJoy established an election mail task force, which met late last month. Among its members is Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, who says she's concerned about actions taken in her state by the Postal Service, including the removal of 26 mail sorting machines.
The changes themselves and the messaging around that, the press coverage of it, and all the controversy has created a scenario where there's confusion among voters about the reliability of what previously was seen as a reliable way of voting this fall.
Benson says she hopes the Postal Service will help restore voters' faith in the reliability of their operations as the election approaches. Brian Naylor, NPR News.
Now we'll turn to education. College towns are welcoming students back, but residents are worrying about COVID-19 tagging along.
College towns are in a dilemma. They need students for their businesses to survive, but bringing students back could mean increasing the risk of COVID-19, and that could mean shutting back down again. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny spent some time near the University of Michigan.
If you're looking for some Wolverine or Go Blue gear and you're in Ann Arbor, you're probably heading to the M Den.
Okay. You want to try anything out? Let me know. I can open a fitting room for you.
You want a tube top with the U of M logo on it? You're in luck. They've got mugs and keychains, even dog beds. Sandy Koski is the manager here. She says business has been challenging. Having the football season canceled, that was a blow.
That was a big shoot.
100,000 people filling the stands at the biggest football stadium in the U.S. means big money. But students are back. About 6,000 moved into campus housing. Many more thousands are off campus. There are some in-person classes. Many more are online.
We're selling a lot of pajamas. And one of my coworkers is like, that's because no one's going anywhere. They're staying cozy in their dorm room. Like,
oh. Sandy Koski's daughter is among the returning students. And Koski says having her back at school, it's done wonders for her mental health.
Getting shut down in March, it was so sad. I think about it now, going to her dorm and packing her up. And it was so sad.
But having students back, it's a mixed bag for residents. In many college towns, students don't just stay on campus, and businesses wouldn't want them to.
I have seating inside, outside.
They go out to eat. They study inside the coffee shops.
21, 20.
They go shopping and out to the bars.
There's just this sense of fear that's palpable. You can feel it from people in the community.
Julie Grand is a city council member in Ann Arbor. She works at the university and loves living in a college town. But that fear, she says, it's fueled by recent memory here in Michigan, a state that got hit hard by the virus in the spring. To date, more than 7,000 people have died.
We know people who were family members of those body bags that were stacked up in the Detroit hospitals. There's a real fear that that could happen again.
Grant says the city of Ann Arbor actually has little control over what the university does. The local government did enact an emergency order, making masks mandatory and limiting the number of people at outdoor gatherings to 25. And statewide, restaurants and bars are still at 50% capacity. That's a tough business model for a bar like Good Time Charlie's, a popular spot in Ann Arbor.
The strawberry mango margarita is really popular.
They're known for a drink called the Fishbowl, served in a 64-ounce jar. You can now order those to go. Adam Lowenstein is a co-owner of the bar.
You want to be able to say, hey, everybody, stay at home. You know, don't go out. Don't go to restaurants. Don't go to bars. But when you're a restaurant and a bar owner and you realize, all right, there's no other alternative for me in this situation.
The whole idea of the business, bars in general, really, is like an epidemiologist's worst nightmare when it comes to spreading coronavirus.
You have people moving from one table to the other, seeing people that they haven't seen all summer. I mean, massive hugs.
That vibe, it doesn't fly in a pandemic.
Right now, we're cracking down on debauchery.
Many nights, they close at 11 instead of 2 a.m. because Lowenstein says COVID rules are hard to enforce when folks get sloppy. All of this comes at a huge cost.
You know, it's like you're not going to make money, but can you lose as little as possible and get through to the other side?
As long as students are drinking fishbowls this fall, Good Time Charlie's has a chance to make it through the winter. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News, Ann Arbor.
Now, here are two reports related to dorm room life. And specifically contrasting how dorm room life is now as compared to what it was in normal times. We have two related reports. Our first one was published a month ago on August 18th, and that was what it's like to move into the dorms amid the pandemic. That was when college students were just returning to campus. And then directly after that, what happens weeks after you move back onto campus and you're forced to quarantine in your dorm room? Here are those reports.
All over the country, college students are moving back into dorms this week. There are strict new rules, a lot of confusion, and, of course, many anxious parents. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny is on a college road trip to see how it's all going. And on the University of Georgia campus in Athens, she saw firsthand how the success of this school year may be decided in these first few hours.
Thousands of students are moving into the dorms this week in Athens, Georgia, about an hour outside of Atlanta. There are familiar scenes, a father and son unloading a futon from the back of their pickup truck.
Do you want to flip it over?
Students with all sorts of stuff, mirrors, rugs, toaster ovens.
I've got my suitcase and stuff in the bag, in my book bag with all my school supplies in it. And I have my succulent, and her name is Susie.
There were a lot of proud parents.
This is the new student here, the valedictorian from Miller Grove High.
And some dad jokes.
The U-Haul gets here in a half hour.
But this year, it is different. Georgia has the highest number of positive cases of coronavirus per capita in the U.S., so there are rules. Only two people can come up to your dorm with you, and students had to sign up for a time slot.
You got an hour to pack as much stuff in as you can.
Everyone has to wear masks.
Yeah, put the mask on now.
And folks packed lots and lots of cleaning supplies.
This is like all the cleaning stuff.
We want the cleaning stuff first, bro.
It's mostly like wipes and stuff to wipe everything down at the end of the day and hopefully not get COVID.
On the way into Russell Hall, a mostly freshman dorm that houses about 900 students, we met Kelsey Lawrence, a freshman.
I brought all my clothes and my shoes. I probably won't have enough space for all of it, but I'm going to try.
She's not exaggerating about those shoes. She has an entire box devoted to her many pairs of Crocs.
My favorite would have to be the tie-dye.
Since Kelsey was only allowed two helpers, her dad and sister head up to her room, leaving mom Vanessa outside.
And she is prepared with everything that you would need if she did get sick. So I sent all the medicines and all everything.
Vanessa's voice is a bit muffled because she's wearing a mask.
They're not going to follow the rules. I mean, you'll have some that will, some that won't.
But she thinks Kelsey will get better care at UGA than at home. And with Kelsey on campus, no one else in the family is at risk if she gets exposed. But that doesn't mean mom isn't anxious.
Now, am I going to be up all night tonight? Yeah, I'm going to be honest about that, yeah.
Across campus in the art building, Professor John Swindler is prepping the studios for Thursday. That's when classes start, many of them in person. Faculty and staff have been working for months to come up with creative solutions to do in-person teaching.
We looked at a lot of different options. You know, we even were looking into the possibility of holding class in a parking garage.
They have easels set up outside for painting classes where it's easier to social distance. Inside, studios have been totally reconfigured.
This isn't actually... Well, here, you can come on in.
Swindler brings us into a drawing studio. Normally, there'd be about 18 students in here.
And so this semester is going to look and feel very different because there's going to be about six or seven at a time in here.
The school has invested not just time, but financial resources into this reopening. The university is processing hundreds of COVID tests a day for students and staff. They spent about $800,000 to send out masks and thermometers.
We were supposed to go play poker at 9:30.
But all of that effort on campus is for naught when night falls and students head off campus to party. By 11 p.m., the bar strip in downtown Athens is overflowing. There are students reuniting. They're hugging, they're talking really closely, they're not social distancing. Most are not wearing masks. And the success of the college's reopening plan, it's ultimately going to be decided in a place like this. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News, Athens, Georgia.
It's back to school time, but of course this year looks very different all across the country. Over the next few weeks, we're going to hear from you about what your new normal looks like. Today, what happens when your dream school just isn't providing...
Sorry, I think we just got lunch here.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's Nautica Nolden, a freshman at New York University who started her first semester of college quarantined in her dorm room for 2 weeks. This was mandatory for students traveling from outside the tri-state area and living in the dorms. Nautica and her other peers couldn't leave their rooms, so they relied on NYU to hand-deliver their meals to them. That exchange at the top, that was Nautica receiving her lunch. That was 4:15 p.m. This isn't the first time food arrived late. We discovered Nautica's story on TikTok, where she posted this.
Quarantine meals that NYU feeds us that just make sense.
The TikTok goes on to show an empty desk and reads, breakfast, nothing. Lunch, nothing. Dinner, all three meals delivered at 6 p.m. Cereal with no milk and warm orange juice, watermelon salad, and watermelon salad with chicken.
Watermelon salad, watermelon salad.
We had to know how that was.
The watermelon's spicy because it has balsamic vinegar and pepper and seasoning and oregano all over it. So I don't even know what it is. It's all spicy. I don't know what the watermelon's purpose is in it.
Let's be honest. Food is just about the only thing a lot of us think about these days. For many, food is what breaks up our plodding days, turned weeks, turned months of this pandemic. And Nautica definitely missed making her own food choices, or choice.
I eat Chick-fil-A every day.
But besides the food, being alone for 2 weeks after living with your family for 18 years sounds like a harsh change. Or so we thought.
I live with my great-grandparents, so it's very quiet in the house all the time. And I'm always by myself. So, like, I'm used to this. I'm relaxing. I'm having me time.
Nautica also used the quiet time to get to know her eventual roommate.
We were really going to use this opportunity when we thought we were quarantining together to get to know each other and bond and stuff. But we didn't have that, so she's just been FaceTiming me from three doors down.
We talked to Nautica a few times during her quarantine. By the end of the 2 weeks, she and her roommate were having a bit of a hard time. But things are looking up. Nautica has now moved in with her roommate, and they are determined to stay on campus. They have a cleaning schedule, and they remind each other to pack hand sanitizer and extra masks. And the school will continue to set limits on social interactions within the dorms.
We're only allowed to have, like, us and our roommate in our room. They haven't said anything about the common meeting spaces like the practice rooms and the study lounges and the dorm buildings. So I think we're allowed to be around each other then, but we have to wear masks every time we leave our dorm room.
Despite the restrictions, Nautica is just happy to be at her dream school, even if it wasn't exactly what she expected.
We're in quarantine watching all these schools get sent home after a week, and so I'm sure a lot of kids who thought about partying before are now thinking, you know, maybe we shouldn't. Like, as long as we follow things now, maybe it'll get better in the future. But we can't ruin it now, or we're not going to get anything in the future.
That's Nautica Nolden, a freshman at NYU, on her new normal.
Now we'll turn to secondary schools. Again, we're going to do this where we contrast what was going on a few weeks ago as compared to what is happening right now. Our first report was published September 7th, and it's about a California teacher who was readying her classroom for when the students might return. Following that is, after school has started, for some students, not having home Wi-Fi means taking classes from their cars. And then finally, transitioning to online learning is tough with students with disabilities. Here are those reports.
We know the challenges for teachers this year, managing new technology, trying to connect with students over computer screens, protecting their own health. Now, add parenting five kids to that mix. That's what Rosie Reed is managing this school year, and she is our next conversation in our series, Learning Curve. She's been teaching for almost 2 decades, but this is her first year at Ignacio Valley High School in California, outside San Francisco. Her district is starting out all virtual, but she had the option to go into the school where she teaches.
Our house is only 1,800 square feet, and it's only 3 bedrooms with 7 people here currently. And so there was really no quiet place to go and work. And in the spring, that was very challenging. I always did my classes sitting on my bed, and I'd hear other teachers talking about how we shouldn't let kids do their Zooms from their bed. And I was, you know, kind of grimacing because I often had to teach from my bed because it was the only available space where I could lock the door and have some quiet.
Did you decorate your classroom?
Oh, yeah. My classroom looks amazing. It has, I turn the lights on every day. I have little twinkle lights all over the walls. I I made it an amazing, beautiful space. A, because I want it to be a place I want to go and be inspired. And B, because we never know when we're going to go back. And I want it to be really ready for students as soon as they give us the go ahead.
Do you feel safe going into the building, taking your kids in there?
I do. So in California, most of our schools are outdoors and they have just wings. So I walk into my wing where very few people come in ever because most people are choosing to work from home. Everybody is very good about masking. And my kids do their school in the morning and then they mostly go outside and play. So it feels pretty safe to me.
And how are your kids doing thus far with virtual learning? Your actual children. I'll ask you about your students in a minute, but your kids.
It's a really interesting question because I feel like they have really thrived in some ways in the last 6 months. And that's really hard for me to say because I appreciate so much everything that's been done for them. And yet I feel like the industrial era model of education with kids sitting so much and receiving so much was really not working for any of my kids. And I think going into all this, I had honestly thought, I guess my kids are just going to be really average students. And in the course of the last 6 months, they have all gotten much better at reading. They've all become better students, like at just sitting down and doing their work, at being proactive, at kind of being responsible for themselves. And I know that not every family has had the luxury of having adults at home to help their kids and, you know, being financially stable. There's so much that goes into that. But I feel like my kids are really thriving in this environment. And that makes me have a lot of mixed feelings about, I want my kids to go back to school. I love their schools, but I want our schools to be different when we go back in a way that's a little more student-centered and creates more space for them.
What about kids who just had a horrible time in the spring and really did lose those months? Are you finding that you need to play catch-up with them? And are there just some kids who aren't going to learn well this way?
There are a lot of kids who aren't going to learn well this way. And I think that that's really important for us to acknowledge that my kid's experience is not every kid's experience. So many students have been the primary caregivers for their younger siblings. They have not been able to focus on their own learning. So many kids have had to go out and get jobs to help support their families. And so the schooling was just really not happening. Other kids, you know, it's really hard for them just to sit on a screen all day, talk about sitting still. And I do think we absolutely have to go back to school as soon as it's safe to do so. And I'm not as worried about the gaps. I think people worry about that too much. I think when kids come back in, the key is just going to be to figure out where our students are and create learning experiences for where they are, not where they should be.
So what about your students? It's been 3 weeks. You've been teaching. You've got, what, 180 students you're responsible for?
So I do have 180 students. And I would say that the first couple of weeks, it was a little bit like crickets. But this last week, they've really started to talk to each other a little bit more. And they're completing most of their assignments. And I feel pretty good about it. It's hard because I think I was a really, really, really good teacher in the classroom. But now I'm working really long hours and not feeling like I'm a really good teacher. But I feel like the kids are going to be okay.
You were teacher of the year last year, right? And you did a good job for those students and others recognized you for that. And I have to imagine you do feel that same level of pressure under really difficult circumstances right now to live up to that.
I think that pressure is always there. I was up late last night working on my lessons for my classes today. And I had the thought several times, I could make this so much easier on myself. But I always feel this pressure to provide my students with a teacher of the year class and experience. And I try to release myself from that and say, hey, that was a different context. But I don't want to ever lower my standards for myself. And that has created a lot of stress for me.
You sound, I mean, we haven't been talking very long, but I can discern that you are by nature an optimistic kind of soul. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I'm a really happy person, and I generally look at tasks and think, how can we solve this problem? Whether it's with a student who is having trouble doing their work, or maybe a systemic problem in the school to help serve more students, or with my own kids. What's the solution to this problem? A lot of my friends are always saying, stop solving problems and just listen. And I'm like, okay. One thing that my husband has noticed about me, though, is that at the end of the day, like late at like 10 or 11, I'll say to my husband, I'm sad. And he's like, no, you're not. You're tired. You only ever say that when you're really, really tired. And I have been saying that a lot more. We're around 9, 9:30, 10 o'clock. I turn to my husband and I say, I'm feeling sad. And he's like, you're just really tired. I say, oh, yeah. Okay. And then I go to sleep. And then the next morning, he's right. I feel better again. So there is a strong overlap for me with incredible exhaustion and sadness. And that has been happening a little bit more, but really only late at night.
Do you give yourself permission, though, to actually just feel sad sometimes? There's a lot going on in the world.
Yeah, there is a lot going on in the world. And it's good to feel that sadness. I also feel like for me, it doesn't really help me. I get stuck there. So it's easier for me to acknowledge the sadness and then move into action mode and really start working on it. And that's what works for me.
Allison Cossey's weekdays have been like many other college students.
Having breakfast, getting ready. To be honest, I don't really dress up very much. I just tried to wear something very comfortable.
Once the 27-year-old gets into her car, she turns up the radio.
Late 90s, early 2000s hip-hop or pop music.
For the drive through London, Kentucky.
There are farms and they are absolutely beautiful.
Her commute ends in a parking lot at Somerset Community College. That's where she attends class in her car.
I open my laptop up and get my materials out, my pencils, my calculator, my notes, erasers, textbook, paper, you name it.
Somerset moved its classes online in March, but since some students didn't have access to Wi-Fi at home, the school set up access points in its parking lots.
They told all of us that we could not come back until COVID-19 had settled down and, you know, they had more of an idea of what the virus was at that time. I felt very frustrated. I felt panicky. I was supposed to graduate in May, and I did not know how long this pandemic was going to last. And I had worked really hard on trying to get this degree. Balancing, working so many hours, and working multiple jobs. I work close to 60 hours. I deliver for a local organic farm. I tutor. I also work as an EMT at a local ambulance service. The reason why I work so much is because I have no financial help from family, so I'm having to do everything myself. Some of the benefits from having to work from my car, I have less distractions, so it just allows me to really focus. And the disadvantages, you're burning gas to keep your car cool. Here in Kentucky, it becomes very humid very quickly, and it stays humid majority of the day. It can be difficult, it can be stressful, but these connections here on campus are definitely helping me get through the pandemic, because I know that the instructors here care about their students, and they want to see other students and myself continue to achieve their goals and to grow.
This week, Allison Cossey completed her studies at Somerset Community College. She now has an associate's degree in applied sciences. And she's not done. Working as an EMT during this time has given her new goals.
I either want to earn my PhD and do biomedical research, or possibly go to med school, maybe go into psychiatry and help treat first responders with mental illnesses like depression, anxiety, PTSD, and whatnot. Knowing that I've completed this and got this degree, I feel absolutely glorious.
Allison Cossey, talking about taking classes in her car in the parking lot of Somerset Community College in London, Kentucky. Congratulations. Good luck.
Students going back to school are adapting to change and uncertainty. For students with disabilities, adjusting to constant change can be more complicated. reporter Tressa Versteeg spoke with two students in Maine about how they're navigating school in the time of COVID-19.
In the spring, when the pandemic forced schools to use online learning, the transition was tough for students.
My name is Kawaya Marie Lichterfeld. I live in Waterville, Maine.
Quiet is a 12th grader who attends a public charter school with a hands-on focus and tight-knit community. She especially loved being on stage at her school's open mic nights. Quiet also has Down syndrome, and it was hard to concentrate while learning at home.
It was really hard to focus on the work you had to do because your parents were just like talking and talking and talking downstairs, and you can't do your work down there.
She learned to be flexible and find a quiet space to work. And one of Quiet's teachers emailed her every day, which was a huge help. The same was true for a middle schooler in Portland, Maine.
My name is Asher Beckett Gray, or Asher Gray. I am going to be in 7th grade. I play video games, I do my tablet, and I make playthings. It's called clay.
Asher has autism and ADHD. The unpredictability and lack of structure at the start of the pandemic were a challenge. So his mom worked with the school to make sure he got the support that he'd had at school in person.
I actually worked with Ms. Farrell on Zoom. She honestly basically helps me almost every day.
But Asher said some of the changes weren't so bad, like not having to choose a new outfit each day and adjusting school hours to be more manageable.
Home learning was pretty cool. I actually had, honestly, the end of the day around 12.
Both Quiet and Asher schools have adopted hybrid models of online and in-person learning. At first, Asher wanted to be completely remote, but then he realized some things were better at school, like eating pizza in the cafeteria and gym class, though he's not sure about playing tag.
Well, you know, there's contact, and I'm pretty sure that you're not supposed to do that during quarantine with people that don't even live with you, so probably highly unlikely.
Quiet's been back for a couple weeks, and she's thrilled. Her teachers are like family. But some things, like wearing a mask and social distancing, are certainly different.
We can't give them hugs or high fives quite yet, not until this thing is going away.
She also said these changes are worth it to be in person again. Asher agrees. He started school September 14th, and the changes are important to getting back his primary concern, Halloween.
The thing I'm worried about is, like, Halloween. I mean, maybe if we wear masks. Maybe with a bit of social distancing, we could do Halloween.
Whether or not Halloween or hugging can happen this year, Quiet and Asher think returning to school in person, at least part of the time, is a step in the right direction. And when more changes come, they'll adapt again. For NPR News, this is Tressa Versteeg.
Now turning to child care. Researchers are warning that nearly half of the U.S. child care centers could be lost to the pandemic.
One of the biggest challenges facing parents in the COVID crisis is child care. Recent research found about half of the 4.5 million child care spots in the country could be permanently lost because of the pandemic. And without child care, it will be hard for many parents to get back to work. Kavitha Cardoza from member station WAMU in Washington, D.C. reports.
And this is how we communicate with each other.
Angelique Spate-Marshall has come up with an ingenious idea to keep the 7 little kids she looks after at her home-based daycare apart. She's given them little walkie-talkies.
They request a toy, the bathroom, a snack.
These toddlers run as far apart from each other as possible to talk.
Hello, Jules.
Spate Marshall constantly reminds children, no hugs or holding hands, no sharing toys or art supplies. Everything she's taught for 23 years, this is the opposite.
That has been definitely a strength, trying to teach the children not to share. They don't understand it. And some, I'm an educator and I don't understand it.
Spate Marshall's laughter covers up serious concerns. She's serving only half the number of kids she used to because of new health guidelines, so she's making far less money. She's had to lay off staff, and she spends many more hours doing paperwork, laundry, disinfecting toys. But she's grateful her daycare is still open. Here in Washington, almost two-thirds of childcare facilities have closed.
It's just kind of rough.
Sylvia Cruz ran a home-based childcare service in D.C. until mid-March. She says with the stringent pandemic restrictions, she just couldn't make the numbers work.
Well, the PPPs, the Clorox, the disinfectant.
Cruz says even if she manages to reopen, she's not sure how she'll afford the new extra expenses.
The thermometers, the face masks, the shields.
They are hanging on by their fingernails.
That's Rian Olven, the CEO of the National Association for the Education of Young Children. She says providers have reached breaking point.
And without a sustained public investment, the sector will collapse.
Olven says more than 80% of providers have reopened, but at substantially reduced capacity. Many aren't sure whether they'll be able to survive long term.
As we look to the financing of the system, parents can't pay any more and early childhood educators can't earn any less.
In recent months, the CARES Act, Federal Emergency Assistance, provided $3.5 billion for early childhood education. Advocates say $50 billion is needed. Diamond Holland tries to keep her worries from her two-year-old daughter. She's a single mom who was laid off from her job as a home health aide.
I'm worried about my unemployment, worried about my rent, worried about all of those things. How am I gonna be able to survive?
Holland is desperately looking for another job while also worrying about her other child, a four-year-old. His preschool is closed, and she's not sure how long family members can help out.
The batteries went dead.
Angelique Spate Marshall watches the toddlers play. The majority of children she cares for have parents who are essential workers, nurses, grocery store workers, and truck drivers. She says any additional funding would help.
Child care powers the economy because when we're caring for the children and the parents are happy, the parents are able to go to work.
Everybody ready? Go!
For NPR News, I'm Kavita Cardoza in Washington, D.C.
For some Texas moms, finding childcare isn't an issue because they can't afford it. And because they can't afford childcare, they can't work. Here's this from the Texas Standard.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard time. I'm David Brown. Among the many major challenges facing parents during this pandemic, childcare. The start of school hasn't provided a whole lot of relief since many districts across Texas are utilizing virtual learning, at least for now. KUT Austin's Claire McInerney brings us the story of one mother's struggle with how to prioritize her kids' education and keep her job.
The first month of shelter in place wasn't too stressful for Chase D. Anderson. Obviously, a global pandemic and knowing people were dying was scary, but she was told the way to help was to stay home. So she did. Both she and her husband's jobs slowed down for a few weeks while their respective organizations figured out how to work remotely. Her kids' elementary school work was also relaxed while the school district figured out the same thing. To distract themselves from the scary news of the virus, they spent a lot of time outside.
And the weather was great. We were biking and it was like this little bubble of an idyllic life in the middle of a scary pandemic.
But then school started having more structure, and she and her husband realized one of them needed to constantly help the kids do online learning. Her husband's job was also getting busier and more demanding, so they had a frank conversation. He made more money and could support them all if she quit or lost her job.
So we made the choice that because my husband's earning potential was so much higher than mine, that I would be the one that was primarily responsible for the kids. So every morning he would go up to the attic and he would work in relative privacy and I would be downstairs with the kids.
Her days were spent getting two young kids on Zoom calls, keeping them on task, trying to take her own video calls, and trying to stay on top of her policy work at the Children's Defense Fund. But her job was taking a back seat because she could barely devote enough time to even write an email. After a few months of this, she hit a wall.
When school was wrapping up and we'd been doing this for a while, there was just some sort of like mental health crisis building in our family. Not like just depression and anxiety feelings, you know? Like I took a week of vacation or like staycation, right? Like I didn't go anywhere. I just didn't work for the first week of June. And I felt like I had like collided with a brick wall in terms of energy, like just... like, all I wanted to do was sleep. Of course, I couldn't because I had to be with the kids, right? But at the end of that week, like ramping back up to work when I started again was just painful.
It was a little easier this summer without school. The girls could play and didn't need a strict schedule. Chasey said they probably watched a little too much TV, but who isn't right now? When she started getting sample schedules from the school district about how e-learning would look this fall, she knew her days would get stressful again. So it was time for her and her husband to have another tough conversation.
I've decided to take a full time off for 3 weeks just at the beginning of the school year. I may extend it for 4 weeks. Just we'll see how it goes. And then after that time, I'm going to go back to my boss and be like, okay, this is what my day looks like. This is how many hours I can put in, and I'll do whatever I can. But my priority has to be getting my kids through the school year.
Chasey knows she's in a really privileged position. Her employer is supporting her taking time off and a possible adjusted schedule. They even offered additional paid time off to other working parents. But it is hard for her to wrap her head around not spending as much time on her work, which helps immigrants.
I know how to do my job. I'm good at my job. It's relaxing to do it because I know what I'm doing, right? There are clear answers, clear steps to take.
And that's huge right now. So much is out of our control. So much is chaotic and scary and unknown. She's going to be walking away from a passion into another unknown situation.
I feel when I'm doing my work, I feel like I'm in control. When I think about last semester trying to help my kids, I ended up crying one time because I couldn't get them on a Zoom meeting. And I ended up like not being able to get her on at the same time that I had postponed a call that I was supposed to be on. And I remember just like crying and being like, I am laughing at myself while I was crying because I'm crying because I couldn't get my kid's Zoom link to work.
There's also a bigger worry at play. Her employer is supporting her taking a step back, so she's not worried about being fired because of this situation. But she is concerned that this will create a domino effect that could end up with her out of a job. The nonprofit gets a lot of grant money, which helps pay her salary. And many of those grants are contingent on meeting certain goals.
If I take too much leave and, you know, my colleagues can't keep the ball rolling enough to meet the grant deliverables, that like we'll lose grant funding, right? And then how do they keep me?
So she expects she'll be up working late at night when her kids are in bed to try and get bigger projects done. For now, she's not focused on what could happen. First, she needs to get through the first week of virtual school. I'm Claire McInerney in Austin.
And now a story about another thing that has changed during the pandemic, and that is companies who are wondering, do we really need this much office space? How the pandemic has emptied buildings, how long, and could it be permanent?
Empty office buildings across the country are starting to present a problem. After all, commercial tenants pay rent to landlords who pay taxes to cities and states that need the revenue. Reporter Ryan Kyloff looks at the unintended consequences of rethinking the office.
Adam Johnson enjoys the office. It helps that he works from one of the nicest buildings in New York, on Fifth Avenue above Bergdorf Goodman. Plus, he likes his coworkers.
I am the only person who's been coming in here since April 1st.
Johnson's a stock picker. He writes an investment newsletter called Bullseye Brief, and he used to share the sixth floor here with a bunch of hedge funders.
Just look at all these empty rooms. I mean, down here as you go by the windows, primo office space, gone, 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 gone.
The Showstopper conference room overlooking Central Park and the Plaza Hotel.
I come in here and I do yoga. I mean, I'm the only person on the entire sixth floor, 40,000 square feet of space altogether. And yeah, the million-dollar conference room is now where I come and do push-ups and sit-ups and kind of hang out.
On the way out, I stopped on 15 floors in the building and found one other person.
Going down.
With commercial real estate, economic crises tend to hit the ground floor first, knocking out the smaller shops and restaurants. Problems don't creep upstairs to the office floors until months later, when tenants break their leases or decide not to renew. So for cities, empty office buildings present a looming crisis. The landlord of Adam Johnson's building did not want to discuss this. Others are less shy.
You know, I feel like it's a little bit of companies' civic duty to return to the office.
Jeff Blau is CEO of The Related Companies, one of the biggest office landlords in New York. As you can imagine, he doesn't love our new work-from-home utopia.
You hear announcements like Google made saying their employees don't have to be back. I think it was June or July of 21. You know what happens when people do that?
Temporary relocations can become permanent relocations. The daytime population shrinks, which means even less traffic into local businesses.
Then the economy is going to be terrible. Companies are going to shrink in size, and they're going to demand less office space. Rents will decline, and it becomes a vicious cycle. So that's exactly what we're trying to prevent here. That's the worst case.
Blau insists his concern is the future of our cities, not his 30 million square feet of office space. He says his buildings are still 100% rented, with all tenants paying, so far. So Blau's been working the phones, trying to get companies back in the office.
There's not many people that I know in industry that I have not spoken to, whether it's finance, media, law firms, private equity, hedge funds.
Blau's pitching them on top-of-the-line safety features. One-way air circulation, double temperature checks, and strict contact tracing. Regardless, some companies are going to reduce their office footprint. Moody's Analytics thinks landlords will have to drop rents 21% this year to find new tenants. That's worse than the Great Recession. Though for some, it's an opportunity. Stuart Saft is a partner at Holland & Knight, a law firm with a big Midtown office. 5 floors, 150 lawyers. 6 months ago, he was looking for ways to reduce space. Maybe fewer private offices, new hires working in a bullpen.
That lasted until about the third week of the pandemic, when all of a sudden everybody realized people do need to have private offices. We need more space than we have right now.
With his lease ending soon, Saft expects to get a great deal on a new one. Companies with cash on hand can sort of use the crisis this way. Just recently, Facebook and Amazon added millions of square feet of space in Manhattan. Smaller players might have to break their leases or downsize, which means whenever people do return to the office, their city could look pretty different. For NPR News, I'm Ryan Kailoff in New York.
Now, staying with this theme related to jobs, here is a report now that looks into the state of the American worker right now during the pandemic.
The coronavirus pandemic has shown us just how essential many workers are, meatpackers, bus drivers, grocery store employees. But lawn signs expressing that appreciation don't necessarily translate to workers feeling safe or valued. One group that reports on workers and labor issues called Payday Report has tracked more than 1,000 worker strikes since March 1st over a range of demands, including hazardous duty pay and better protective equipment. To hear more about these issues, we've called Erica Smiley. She's the executive director of Jobs with Justice, which is a group to advance workers' rights. Erica Smiley, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
These last few months have seen just dramatic changes in everything, you know, in this country. I mean, the global pandemic, which has killed more than 180,000 people in the U.S., leading to the highest unemployment rate since the Depression. And then we've seen these, you know, nationwide protests over racial injustice. We've seen, you know, worker strikes accelerating, something we really haven't seen for quite some time in this country. So, and then there are the longer term trends, like the fact that consistent positive wage growth has occurred in only 10 of the last 40 years. Is there something that you would be willing to identify as a central issue for workers?
So, you know, I think when you ask the question of what is the core issue, I think in some ways it's actually just basic dignity and respect. And of course, that can't just be a thank you for your service. It actually has to come with the equipment that people need to do the job, the pay that they need to sustain themselves and their family, the health care that allows them to take care of themselves, ideally before they get sick, let alone if they get sick. That's actually what we mean when we say dignity for essential essential workers. We're talking about all of those things. We wouldn't send soldiers into war without the equipment they need to fight. I mean, everyone would agree that that would be cruel. And yet we want to send nurses and grocery workers and teachers into these what are currently hazardous work sites without the equipment they need or the protections for their families to continue to be able to do the work in a sustainable way.
I mean, are you convinced that this is, in fact, an inflection point? I mean, it's an inflection point in part because of circumstances that we've discussed, but are you persuaded that this is an inflection point in terms of actual changes, structural changes in these areas that you are committed to?
Mm-hmm. Michelle, honestly, like, I want to distinguish between the fact that I am hopeful and I feel like it is urgent that we make some of these structural shifts for the sake of our democracy. When workers have some aspect of decision-making, when there's already a role for them to have a voice and figure things out, when nurses already had a plan for a crisis, be it public health or otherwise, then our communities were safer. So I firmly believe that this is a moment where it is critical for us to come together and navigate what systems need to be in place in the future. We may not be able to prevent another virus, but we can definitely shape our response in a way that prevents more deaths. That said, I want to clarify, I don't think it's guaranteed. It really depends on everyday people, our political leaders and employers to come together to actually put some of these things in place. And we're lucky because cities like Los Angeles have already passed the idea of worker-driven health and safety boards in different sectors. And, you know, I think it's going to be critical at the national level as well to think through how we create not just task forces of experts and health officials, but where we have essential workers actually at the table making decisions and suggesting proposals for how to deal with the next crisis. We think this is how democracy works. I mean, in some ways, this crisis has exposed that our democracy has been struggling for a minute. This idea that a democracy means that you vote just once a year has never actually been good. Like, you know, a democracy means, you know, the majority of people having some access to decision making in all aspects of their lives, whether it's civic or employment. In many ways, this is a chance for us to fix that, to right that wrong that's been happening long before the pandemic started, to actually increase the different channels that working people can have a direct say in our society and in our lives.
You know what I wanted to ask you, if you don't mind my getting into your business, what are you going to do for Labor Day?
What am I going to do? Oh, yeah, look, actually, two things. So we have a national tribute for essential workers tonight at 8 o'clock, and we're really excited about that. I think we're going to have some stars actually come on and just kind of give some attention and praise to essential workers who've been busting their butts for the last 6 months or so. And additionally, we created a memorial wall. It's actually just www.theworkersmemorialwall.org, because we realized that in the last few months, people have lost coworkers and have no place to share anything about them. It's not like people could go to the memorials or anything like that. And so we created this space so that essential workers could memorialize their coworkers online. So I'll be working on those two things. And then, quite honestly, like many of us, I will be doing those two things at home with my family, where we've all been sheltering in place. And so we'll be trying to maximize what we can do virtually, given the year and the moment.
That's Erica Smiley. She's the Executive Director of Jobs with Justice, a national network to advance workers' rights. Erica Smiley, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Michelle. Take care.
And that is your coronavirus update for this Wednesday, September 16th, 2020. I'm Michael from the Recording Library of West Texas. Coming up, national news from USA Today, followed by local news at 3 o'clock. And here are some of the articles that our volunteers will be reading today. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Board hires experienced interim superintendent. Myers says next week will determine if case numbers are going to spike. Midland Health CEO says decision on COVID vaccine is about what's best for community. And from the Odessa American, council makes it official. Taxes are going up along with rates. Ector County trials can resume. Dumping enforcement bolstered, taxes raised. And teachers powering through the pandemic. Those stories and more at 3 o'clock. At 6, it's the Wall Street Journal. And at 7, our Center Solutions podcast that we do in coordination with Centers for Family and Children's. This one will be an encore presentation tonight at 7 o'clock. And it's a departure from the usual format in that they're not in the studio. What they did was go out to the Sibley Nature Center. And when they took this trip, that is Christy Edwards and Melanie Seiss from Centers for Family and Children and our own executive director, Bailey Hennis, from the Recording Library. When they made the trip out to Sibley, they were enjoying some of the sights and sounds of nature, the smells, and they